Monster Professor.
Welcome to the Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And today, I want to answer a couple of really common questions. One of those being, what is a monster? What's your definition of monster, Monster Professor? And another is, well, maybe it's not so common, but it's the extended version of my answer to that question, which is, what makes a horror story? What makes a monster story? I think the answer to the first question is connected to the second. So I want to get into my theory on horror today. So what's a monster and horror theory? Speaking of monsters, I have to go to great lengths to keep my cat quiet in this house. I don't know how many of you have cats who are noisy and have attitudes, but I thought they were supposed to be quiet, low-maintenance pets, and I got one somehow that has the personality of... There's a cartoon years ago called Aqua Teen Hunger Force, and of the three weird characters, one of them was Shake or Master Shake, and he had this... My cat has that exact personality somehow, I know not how. So I think I have appeased her enough for her to be quiet for a little bit this episode. All right, so this, I said a common question, what makes a monster, what's your definition of monster? By that I mean, over the past, I don't know, 6 months or so, you know, every now and then I'll receive comments or emails from people from who listen to the show. A lot of times those are people I've known in the past, say other friends or former students or things like that. Not always, though. Sometimes they're strangers. But I'll receive comments and questions. And in the past couple months, I've also had the privilege of visiting some college classes, literature classes, even had a chance to visit a couple of podcasting classes, which were pretty cool. And those students always have excellent questions and comments for me. And one of them that keeps popping up, what's your definition of monster? As far as we can tell, you've never actually defined it on the show. That's correct, I haven't. It's called the Monster Professor, but I won't tell anyone what I think a monster is. Not yet, not till today. One young listener, a young lady named Sydney Lashbrook, she said it was okay to drop her name, sent me an extensive email trying to figure out exactly what it is. I think one of the first things that bothered her was that I talked about creatures that didn't necessarily seem monstrous to her, such as the phoenix in my episode on monstrous birds. I also had... very human-like creatures in addition to very non-human-like creatures. Another question that keeps popping up is, will you cover real-world human monsters like serial killers or mass murderers or tyrants? I plan to, but so far, my definition of monster perhaps holds a little bit more toward its roots. So first let's lay out the roots of the word monster. Where does that come from? It entered English in the early 14th century. And it's from the Latin that means this divine omen, especially this a bad one, like a bad portent. And it was the word that they gave to those creatures of livestock or whatever they had that were born malformed or abnormal, a sheep with two heads or a calf with like six legs or something like this. This would be a monster. And by that they meant, one, it's unnatural. And this even applied to human beings with severe birth defects as well, but it was more often, I believe, applied to animals. And so it's more than just this animal was born unnatural or abnormal. But that also meant that bad things were on its way, on the way, like earthquakes or droughts or terrible storms or war. When one of these things is born on your farm, bad things are going to come. And that's what you have as a monster. It also, a while back used to, well, it took on this meaning of like, hugeness or immense size, but not till much, much later, not too long after, monster started being used to mean this kind of abnormal birth, it was extended to discussing what we'd otherwise call fabulous creatures or fabulous beasts, as in those animals that are built out of parts of other animals in mythology, like a griffin, for instance. And so monster has meant that kind of thing as well. As far as somebody who's just really terrible or wicked or cruel, that's from somewhere in the 1500s, I think it is. So what ties all this together? Well, I think something that is essentially a monster is something that is abnormal or not normal, not natural, as in perhaps unique, as in something went wrong and there's just one of these kinds in the world, or maybe something that was never supposed to happen, so like a reversal of what is natural. So you would apply, I would say something is a monster if you have the only person in the world who has hooves for feet and spits acid, for instance. I don't know, I'm just making this a terrible concept for a monster, but off the top of my head, that's what came. And so some person is born and he has hooves for feet and he spits acid. That's a monster. It's this unnatural thing and something that will probably bring evil. Although, is that a self-fulfilling prophecy? The people who think you're going to bring evil, turn you into an evil person by attacking you. That's part of the horror story, actually, we're going to get into. But I think you could also say that the monster could be extended to something that's the reversal of natural things. Like if you have suddenly a frog that talks to you, then I think you can call that a monster as well. So I would extend it everything from fabulous beasts to these kind of horrific, unnatural abnormalities to reversals of those things that are natural. What about ghosts and things like this? Perhaps it's not natural for people to hang around even after they're dead. And so, yeah, sure, I'll throw those in there with monsters too. So far in this show, I've only been interested in those things that are generally regarded to be fantastical. Everything from vampires and zombies to, say, golems and ghosts and werewolves and these kinds of things. Of course, some people have taken issue with the fact that, you know, I'll discuss like sentient robots and ghosts, and they're like, those things are real. You can't talk about those like they're not real. Well, I think if you paid attention to the show, I talk about all these monsters as if they're real, because what do I know? Maybe some of them are. It's not really my job to figure that out. I've just made it my job to talk about them. And I hope if they are real out there, that they like the show and they don't hate it, because I don't want to be attacked anytime soon, although I'm ready for you. All right, so what is all, what does any of this have to do? That was an extended answer, and maybe I don't know if I've defined it clearly enough to satisfy everyone, but it's a pretty good start. And what does all this have to do with what I call horror structure or horror theory? I've read a bunch of stuff that gets close to what I might consider a horror theory. In fact, the best that keeps popping, or the I haven't really found anybody else who wrote on it any better than H.P. Lovecraft did. You know, a bunch of people have explored some of it in different ways. Stephen King is one of them. Some script doctors in LA kind of write some books that get close to it. I don't think anybody's been better at it than H.P. Lovecraft, especially in his very long essay, Supernatural Horror and Literature. That one is fantastic, from that famous first sentence down through all of the examples he gets through. But I tend to think of it in a little bit different way, and it's one that I laid out in a couple of publications of mine. So if you want to check these out to read more into what I'm talking about in this episode, you might check out a craft essay of mine called Think Like a Horror Writer. That was published in Prime Number Magazine, issue 73. There's a link to it on my website under my essays section on my essays page. And I actually wrote I took a lot of those ideas along with many others, and I wove them into a story called A Theory of Game, A Theory of Horror. And that's one of the stories in my recent book of stories, the collection that just came out through Press 53, Oh Monstrous World. That's available now. So check out that story too if you're interested in seeing how I would extend these ideas and use them and play with them. But I think ultimately this theory is just kind of a descriptive one, in that I see the monster story or the horror story working on essentially four pillars. Ever so briefly, those four pillars are, we'll get into detail in each one of them, but I call them confinement, or you might say confinement and isolation, all as one. The other, the decline, and something I call implication or inevitability. I think a horror story or a monster story needs those four pillars to be fundamentally a monster story or a horror story. And I haven't said anything about fear necessarily, and that these stories explore the essence of fear. But I think that that element of fear is a part of all of it. And so then might say the whole structure is based on different versions of fear or different aspects of fear. But, and so I think it's each one of those pillars has that built into it. So what do those things mean, or what does this have to do with the monster? Well, to zoom out a little bit, there's a writer named Paulo Coelho who he wrote The Alchemist, of a recent author, a living author. Oh God, is he still living? I'm pretty sure he is. I hope I didn't just jinx him. let's just go with it. He's living, of a living author. Last time I checked, his book, The Alchemist, was translated into more languages than any other book. And so it was a worldwide phenomenon. It's a guy who understood stories that weren't so fragile that they couldn't survive translations, or maybe possibly even bad translations. So something about this, or this guy figured out something about these universal story structures. And in an interview, Richard Handler did this interview with him, and he asked him about stories, and Paulo Coelho said, there are only two types of stories, the voyage of discovery and a stranger comes to town. Well, the voyage of discovery, I think that's Paulo Coelho's way of kind of exploring these two ideas. The voyage of discovery, and I think that matches up quite well with the archetypical hero's journey or the hero's quest. Something that I think Joseph Campbell clarified quite well as he tried to distill out a lot of Carl Jung's ideas. I think we even see it in Vladimir Propp. He was a Russian theorist scholar who took all of the Russian fairy tales that we have. They're extraordinary, by the way. And he noticed that they all follow this set of patterns that seem to be similar throughout. And so he diagrammed all of these fairy tales in a remarkable way. Check out Vladimir Propp if you're interested in that as well. And this story about the hero going out into leaving the home and the known world and stepping across the threshold into the unknown, into the other world. And the hero does so, and he meets different enemies, and he contends with different, say, monsters or villains. And as he does so, gains power, adds friends, gains more friends, learns something about himself in the end, and then returns. And I think you can see that in everything from, say, everything from like Star Wars and Wizard of Oz, back to some of the more epic, more ancient epic poems. But I think there's the other side of that story that's almost the reverse or almost the dark mirror opposite in every way. And as Coelho said, a stranger comes to town. That's the other one, he thinks. That's what I think is fundamentally the horror story. I don't think a horror story has to be slasher, gore, blood and guts kind of thing. I don't think that necessarily makes it a horror story. I think you can have a horror story even without a monster or a killer or any sort of death. It's when that thing that feels fundamentally other crosses the threshold into your world. So unlike the quest story where the hero leaves the ordinary world into the other world, instead in the horror story, something brings that thing that is essentially the other into your world. This thing gets into your house. This thing comes to your town. It's been provoked or awakened or created, and here it comes for you. Now, it takes more than just that, I think. I think what it takes is confinement, as in what is essentially a horror story, you want to cut off the characters from this communion or connection or even, lifelines of help to the outside world. And so that's where you have confinement and isolation. And that can be everything from characters are stranded in a gothic castle on an island and there's a storm raging so there's no way out, or you're in space in a spaceship and you can't get away, or you're just in a house out in the woods and you can't get a cell phone signal and someone cut the lines, or these kind, or maybe you're in a town in which no one believes you for some reason because of some conspiracy. Whatever that confinement, that isolation is the setup. And then the other steps across the threshold. Now, the other is where I think the monster comes in. The other is that anything that feels inhuman, unnatural. And depending on the story, that can be everything from something that seems physically like an unnatural beast, like a werewolf, for instance, or a vampire, all the way to, I think you can take the horror structure and run with it and say perfectly realistic or even literary ways. Consider, for instance, I mean, we can go even further than something that seems quite obviously horror, like the famous story by Joyce Carol Oates called Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been? In which this terrifying based off of a real serial killer guy, Arnold Friend, shows up to Connie's house and slowly talks her out of her house, slowly builds up terror in the story. That's a horror story. You have this thing that is very much other. In fact, you can see all these details about how he seems perhaps not quite human. Well, I think as a storytelling structure, it works even if it's not that literally horrific. Take, for instance, another famous literary story by Raymond Carver, Cathedral. In this story, you have this. It's essentially just like some jerk of a guy and his wife, and he's not employed, and he's at home, and she's got this friend that she corresponds with, this guy who's coming to visit for a night or two. This friend is blind. He also happens to be intelligent and nice, almost the opposite of her husband, and he feels threatened by this blind guy coming to his house. In fact, not only threatened, but kind of scared of what it means that this guy lives blind and travels and is this kind of sensitive thinker kind of guy, but he can't get out of it. He doesn't have a job to run off to. He can't talk his way out of it. He has to give in and just hang out through this evening. So he's confined here. And then the other steps across the threshold, right? You look at this story and how it plays out, and it follows this horror structure much more than it follows, say, a type of quest structure. So what is it that makes this thing the other? Well, like I said, anything that not only feels not right in the story or to the characters, but maybe something that reverses the natural order of things. Then you have when this other steps across the threshold and what brought him across the threshold into your world. That's connected to what I call implication or inevitability. But as the story goes along, you have the decline in which the main characters don't grow in strength and power and wisdom like they do in a quest story. Instead, they're in the decline. They lose friends one by one. They lose their ability to fight back one piece by piece. Sometimes this weakness is like a literal weakness, as in they're injured and they ran out of bullets kind of thing, and they can't like get away as fast as they could at the beginning of the story. Or sometimes, you know, maybe it's not as literal. Maybe it's like they're declining morally. They're making worse and worse decisions, becoming more and more selfish or more and more cruel. Or maybe they're losing their sanity. One way or another, the world unravels and falls apart around them because this other is there. And then of the fourth pillar, implication or inevitability, I think they're very different, but they function in the story the same way. By implication, I mean you're at fault. You're the reason the other stepped across the threshold into this world. So you are implicated in the horror itself. By you, I mean the main characters are the characters who are contending against the other. And that's what leads to what you might call the horror reverse. If I'm, you know, in the cheesy cliche moment of finally killing the monster, then you go, "We were the monsters all along. Now we see who the true monster is." That kind of thing. That's like the horror reverse. But it's also much more complex than that. Examples of these kinds of things. How about the novel or the movie, either one, Jaws? That one's more literally a horror thing. And you can say, well, that's just a shark attack type of movie. What's horrific about that? That's a very natural thing, right? Well, fair enough, but most sharks aren't actually as as vicious and bloodthirsty in this way that Jaws is, that goes after human flesh in this way. Normally they act much more like animals because normally they are. But about the implication, why do people keep being eaten by Jaws in Jaws? Why don't they just stay out of the water? I mean, if there's a shark in there and it's eating you, all you really have to do is just like not go in the water. Then you're fine. So why did this monster keep killing everyone and terrorizing? Well, it's not because the shark is evil. It's because it was 4th of July weekend in that little beach town. They didn't want to shut down the beaches, they being what the main power players in the town, the mayor and the one who's the boss of essentially the sheriff, right? He said, we got to shut the beach down to save lives. And the business owners and politicians are like, no way. This is our biggest money-making weekend of the year. You're going to throw the whole town into bankruptcy. We're going to lose our businesses. You can't do that. Just go out and kill the thing and call it good. And so why was the monster attacking? Well, it's their fault. They fell into the sin of greed and they were implicated. And so that's that feature of implication. I mean, this shows up everywhere, even in things like, let's see, like in the 70s, if we're sticking, I don't know why I'm sticking with 70s movies right now, but they were good. How about the movie Alien, right? Like, it's, how is it Ripley's fault that an alien got on board? She did everything right. Well, yeah, she did. But why did they even set down on that planet anyway? And why did they even go investigate to get infected with this alien thing? It's because the company they worked for set him up, lied to him, framed him, and got him there. They wanted the alien to bring back for their own research purposes, for their own military purposes. And so who was at fault all along? Not the monster. The monster's just the monster. Who's at fault for bringing that thing across the threshold? It is we. We are the ones at fault. And so that's implication. But inevitability works like this too, in that this kind of thing was just destined to happen. This is part of human nature. This is the cyclical nature of sin or crime. It's gonna, if you aren't aware of the ghosts of your past, then they're going to rise back up, or it's inevitable that they do. Very often haunted house stories have this sense to them, whether it's like Shirley Jackson's Haunting of Hill House or The Shining or these kinds of things, in which there's this crime that has happened here in the past that people are irrevocably drawn to recreating. And I think in many ways, because it's inevitable, maybe it's not the fault of the main characters at the beginning, but they become at fault. I think there's some connection to that, as in being blind to your own shadows, your own tendency toward evil, or maybe human nature and history. If you're blind to these kinds of things, then you are kind of doomed to repeat them. So you take all these kinds of thing, all these four elements, and I think fear is woven into all of them. Fear and confinement and decline and implication or inevitability, and definitely the other. I think they're all based on that as well. It's different types of fears. I think then you have a horror story. So the types of creatures that serve this function of the other, that serve this function of crossing the threshold and bringing the unknown, bringing the terror and pressing people who are implicated or inevitably destined to run into these kinds of problems, that whatever serves that function is the monster. And so that can be everything from a regular person who doesn't have the same types of moral senses that we do, say a Hannibal, the Cannibal Lecter or something like that, or an actual serial killer or something, all the way to some type of monster. But it also means that there is something that the other comes here to teach us, even though that might be the harshest lesson you ever receive, and also maybe the last lesson you ever receive, even if it's like the misfit in Flannery O'Connor's A Good Man Is Hard to Find. There's something this thing can teach you, and I think that's one of the features of this podcast that I keep trying to explore. Like one question brought up by a brilliant young student at one of these discussions I had, it was with a podcast, I think, wanted to know, of all the monsters, that we know of in our era, which might be, I forget how he said it, which might be the most relevant or the most significant. And on the spot, I said zombies. And I explained why in the zombie episode. I think zombies got really popular, but I also think everybody could tell that there was some type of truth. There was something about the zombie that was telling us something that we needed to hear, or showing us something more starkly that we were seeing a little bit everywhere. And what is that thing? Well, maybe I'll just leave it. I think I'm pretty sure I discussed that in the zombies episode, so maybe I'll let it lie there before it turns into a whole zombie discussion. So when I teach this kind of thing to my creative writers, my fiction writers, when I teach them how horror structure works as opposed to how quest structure works, I teach both, of course, but how they can use these in their stories. When I teach them, I try to, after we kind of learn how these things work and we all discuss these fundamentals in some of the horror stories that they know or their favorites, I like to show them how it can all work in things that don't quite seem horror but do feel horror. And so one thing I like to use is this really short cartoon. It's like 8 minutes long, something like that, 6 minutes. It was from Warner Brothers back in the day, and it was called One Froggy Evening. But I think a lot of people might be familiar with it, as the little singing, dancing frog that sings, "Hello, my baby. Hello, my darling." That little Michigan J Frog, I think, is what the Warner Brothers people named this little guy. And you watch this, and it's far and away one of the most popular short cartoons that Warner Brothers ever did. Maybe not as popular of a character as, say, Bugs Bunny or something, but I don't think anybody can name a single Bugs Bunny episode that is more popular than that single singing frog episode. And so there's something about it that really clicked with people for decades and decades. And you watch this thing and you realize this has everything that a well-structured horror type of story has. You have essentially this character, this guy who's like works as some blue-collar job demolishing buildings. He finds some kind of a secret compartment at the bottom, at the foundation of this building, opens it up. There's a box inside. He opens up the box and up pops this frog that starts dancing and singing ragtime songs. And then the first thing he thinks is, you see just dollar signs everywhere, because the humans do not speak in this story. You see dollar signs, and he does his greedy hand rubbing thing, and then he imagines showing this frog on Broadway and raking in fame and fortune. And so he tries it, and he uses all of his savings and all of his money and efforts. Well, he tries to get producers, and he just embarrasses himself, because anytime the frog is seen by anyone other than this guy who has it, it just acts like a frog. And then in private, it starts singing and dancing again. And so bit by bit, he's losing all of his money. He starts losing his sanity. He eventually is out on the streets in the cold, sleeping on park benches with this frog next to him. He ends up getting in trouble with the cops and gets thrown into an insane asylum, or a lunatic asylum, I think it is in the cartoon. And then he finally gets out, and years and years later, and his whole life is ruined, and he puts this little frog in the foundation of this new building. And then they cut to the future world of like 2002 or something like that, with lasers everywhere. And then they demolish, these future people demolish this building, and this future guy opens up this this container and then pulls out the box, and then up pops the frog, and he starts singing and dancing ragtime again. And then this future guy in his spacesuit sees dollar signs and rubs his hand greedily and runs off, and that's the end. You have it all there. You have, talk about the other, this thing that crosses the threshold. In the whole little cartoon, the human beings don't speak. Anytime they are speaking to each other, it's behind glass, so you can't hear any human beings. The only thing that has human voice is the animal, which is the opposite of how it's supposed to be, right? Humans are supposed to speak and animals aren't. And here we see the horror reverse in this cartoon. And so you have this little frog coming from some unknown beyond who has this horrific feature to him, but it's not himself that makes the horror. It's the characters are implicated. It's the greed, the sin of greed, that brings him down. And so, and then he goes through this decline. He's completely confined because the frog, confined and isolated, this frog won't sing for anybody else, and no one's with him. So he's the only person in the whole world who knows the truth about this frog, and no one will believe him. And so you have all four pillars. And then at the very end, the inevitability takes hold, as in there is no getting away from man's greed. It's part of human nature. Even in the future, this same thing is going to play out just as it has before, the end. You see these. So I think that's there's nothing kind of gory or terrifying in that story necessarily, but it's a perfect horror story. And so that's it. Well, that's at least one way that I like to kind of convey my theories on exactly how horror can work as a story structure without being dependent on content that seems gothic or gruesome, this kind of thing. So let's see how we, I'm just about out of time here. That I think there are a couple of other places we could go. For instance, I think there are three kind of fundamental points of morality that turn almost all horror stories, if not all horror stories. Three points of morality that I think are I call the classical flaws, because they come from ancient Greece. But I'm definitely going to run out of time before getting to those. And we have future podcasts. We can get into those later. So for this episode, I hope it wasn't too kind of abstract or academic. I hope it's useful, if nothing else, for those of you kind of playing around with stories, or you're feeling like maybe something's not quite clicking in some story or book that you're working on, or comic or film or whatever, that if you're feeling like that, I hope some of this might help and help you see like some element or tweak that you need to add or make to it. And if nothing else, I hope you get a sense of what kinds of things draw me to them as monsters, or what kinds of things I'm interested in having on the show. There are many more excellent questions posed by listeners and by students I've talked to that I didn't get to today, but if nothing else, there's a little bit of my theoretical foundations. Again, if you want to check out my brief writing on my theories here that I shared with you, check out Press 53 or Prime Number Magazine's issue 73, Think Like a Horror Writer. I think the way that it's available online for free, I think you got to scroll down to the end of that issue. It's all in a single page. to find that essay, and also check out my new book that has a story in it that uses this horror structure. This story is called A Theory of Game, A Theory of Horror. That's in the book Old Monstrous World, available on Amazon.com or at the publisher storefront, Press 53. So thank you very much for listening, because if you made it this far, you just survived another episode of The Monster Professor.